This CLE is based on the appellate decisions released in New York State in January of 2020 dealing with issues related to civil procedure. The selected decisions were summarized, and the summaries were posted on the New York Appellate Digest website, and those summaries were then compiled into the January 2020 Civil Procedure Update pamphlet, and it's that pamphlet which forms the written materials for this CLE. The page references are to the pamphlet. First case, Nelson v. Leiter, on page 6. It has to do with the requirement that an out-of-state doctor submit an affidavit as opposed to an affirmation for a case that's in New York. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the statement by a New Jersey dentist offered by the plaintiff in this dental malpractice action was not admissible because it was not in the form of a sworn affidavit. Therefore, plaintiff did not raise a question of fact in opposition to the defendant's motions for summary judgment. The court wrote, while an otherwise qualified expert physician, osteopath, or dentist who is not licensed in this state may submit a statement in support of or in opposition to a party's position in a case, that statement must be in the form of a sworn affidavit. CPLR 2106 Subdivision A, which permits such a statement to be in the form of an affirmation, only applies to attorneys, physicians, osteopaths, and dentists licensed to practice in the state of New York. Next is Matter of Spectrum News on pages 6 and 7. It has to do with whether an order is appealable. First Department, dismissing the appeal in this Freedom of Information Law case, determined the interim decision was not an appealable paper, depriving the First Department of jurisdiction. The court wrote, this proceeding stems from Spectrum News' attempts to gain access to video files from the voluntary body camera experiment. Specifically, Spectrum filed a Freedom of Information Law request for unredacted videos from the New York Police Department's voluntary body camera program begun in 2014. The New York Police Department denied the request, claiming that unredacted files were exempt from disclosure under FOIL. Spectrum then commenced this Article 78 proceeding, seeking a judgment compelling respondent, that's the New York Police Department, to comply with its request. The parties stipulated that out of a disputed 328 videos, only 30 would be the subject of the hearing. Supreme Court then issued an interim decision, which was not the product of a motion for relief. Instead, the interim decision, among other things, permitted respondents to redact the faces of persons other than officers from any video footage recorded by the body cameras and to redact certain communications between officers. Supreme Court granted petitioner leave to appeal from the interim decision. This appeal is thus taken from an interim decision which is not an appealable paper. The lack of an appealable paper here deprives the court of jurisdiction and requires dismissal of Spectrum's appeal, albeit without prejudice. Whereas here, a party brings an appeal from a non-appealable paper, this court regularly dismisses the appeal for lack of jurisdiction. While there are instances where this court has deemed a paper denominated as a decision to nonetheless be appealable because it contained all the hallmarks of an order, that is not the situation here. Next is Jeanette S. on pages 7 and 8. From the civil procedure standpoint, it just deals with a failed attempt to amend the Bill of Particulars. Fourth Department held that the court properly granted the motions to strike plaintiffs' in quotes supplemental bills of particulars inasmuch as they were actually amended bills of particulars. And the court went on to find that the amended bills of particulars are a nullity inasmuch as the note of issue had been filed and plaintiff failed to seek leave to serve amended bills of particulars before serving them on the defendant. Next is the Lomelie case, or Lomelie, on pages 8 and 9. It deals with discovery in a class action. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that plaintiff's request for an extension to move for class certification should have been granted, citing CPLR 901A and 902. The court wrote, a plaintiff's need to conduct pre-class certification discovery to determine whether the prerequisites of a class action set forth in CPLR 901A can be satisfied constitutes good cause for the extension of the 60-day time period fixed by CPLR 902. So again, that case dealt with allowing more time for pre-certification discovery in a class action. Next is Diamond on pages 9 and 10. It's another class action case, this time involving a class action by tenants for breach of the warranty of habitability based on loss of heat and hot water. First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the breach of warranty of habitability cause of action should not have been dismissed. The court wrote, in order to prove a claim for breach of the warranty of habitability, plaintiffs must show the extensiveness of the breach, the manner in which it affected the health, welfare, or safety of the tenants, and the measures taken by the landlord to alleviate the violation. The heating systems that failed served multiple housing units, and proof of New York City Housing Authority's efforts to repair each system will be common to numerous class members. In order to address any concerns with the size or disparity of the class, the court can designate subclasses consisting of tenants of a particular New York City Housing Authority complex, development, or building. Next is Nestor on page 10. It has to do with waiving the statute of limitations defense, and it concerns a default in a foreclosure action. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the defendants in this foreclosure action, by defaulting, had waived the statute of limitations defense. The court wrote, CPLR 3211 subdivision E provides that a defense based upon the statute of limitations is waived if not asserted in an answer or in a timely motion to dismiss pursuant to CPLR 3211. Such a motion is timely if it is made before service of the answer is required. Here, the defendants never answered the complaint, and their cross motion to dismiss the complaint was served at least 6 months after the service of the answer was required. Therefore, unless the defendant's default is vacated or excused, the defendants waived their statute of limitations defense, and in their cross motion, the defendants did not seek relief from that waiver. Accordingly, the Supreme Court should not have granted that branch of the defendant's cross motion, which was to dismiss the complaint insofar as asserted against them as time barred, without first determining whether the defendants were properly held in default. So, unless a default is vacated, the statute of limitations defense is waived. Next is Torres on page 12. It's a case in which the court found the verdict to be inconsistent and it ordered a new trial. Second Department, reversing the Supreme Court, held the inconsistent verdict in this Labor Law 241 Subdivision 6 action required a new trial. The trial court had dismissed the action. The court wrote, the jury returned a verdict finding that the city defendants violated the industrial code, but that the violation was not a substantial factor in causing the accident. Although the instructions on the verdict sheet directed the jury to end its deliberations if it found that the violation of the industrial code was not a substantial factor in causing the accident, the jury further found that the injured plaintiff was negligent and that his negligence was a substantial factor in causing the accident. The jury then proceeded to apportion fault 25% to the city defendants and 75% to the injured plaintiff. After the Supreme Court instructed the jurors to reconsider its verdict, the jury returned a second verdict, which was identical to the first verdict, except that the jurors did not answer the questions as to the injured plaintiff's negligence and apportionment of fault. When a jury's verdict is internally inconsistent, the trial court must direct either reconsideration by the jury or a new trial, citing CPLR 4111, subdivision C. On reconsideration, the jury is free to substantively alter its original statement so as to conform to its real intention, and is not bound by the terms of its original verdict, inasmuch as that verdict was not entered by the court. Even after reconsideration by the jury, a trial court has discretion to set aside a verdict which is clearly the product of substantial confusion among the jurors. And the court found that this verdict was inconsistent and ordered a new trial. The trial court had dismissed the case. Next is U.S. Bank on page 13. It deals with a party's right to intervene. This was a foreclosure action. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the party which purchased the property after foreclosure was commenced should have been allowed to intervene in the foreclosure proceedings. The court wrote, on September 10, 2015, the plaintiff commenced this action to foreclose a mortgage on premises owned by the defendant, Carrington. Carrington failed to answer the complaint. On March 23, 2016, Carrington sold the premises to the appellant, 1698 Management Corp. The appellant was entitled to intervene as of right pursuant to CPLR 1012 subdivision A, since it established that the representation of its interest by the parties would be inadequate, that the action involved a disposition of title to real property, and that it would be bound and adversely affected by a judgment of foreclosure and sale. So the motion to intervene should have been granted pursuant to CPLR 1012 subdivision A. Next is matter of DeFrank on page 14. It's a family law case, custody case, and it deals with the court's jurisdiction. Second Department, reversing family court, held that neither New York nor Pennsylvania was the home state of the child under the statutes, and under the circumstances, New York has jurisdiction to make an initial custody determination. The court wrote, although the child was living in New York for 6 consecutive months immediately before this proceeding was commenced, he was not living with a parent because the mother did not move to New York until January 2018. The maternal great-grandmother was not a person acting as a parent, as that term is defined by statute, because she had not been awarded legal custody of the child by a court and did not claim a right to legal custody of the child. So the child was not with a parent in New York for 6 months, which is a requirement. The court went on, Pennsylvania did not have jurisdiction over the matter. Pennsylvania also did not qualify as the home state of the child, since the child had been living in New York for more than 6 months prior to the commencement of the proceedings, citing Domestic Relations Law Section 76. Therefore, the child did not have a home state at the time of commencement. In such a case, New York may exercise jurisdiction if the child and at least one parent have a significant connection with the state, other than mere physical presence, and substantial evidence is available in this state concerning the child's care, protection, training, and personal relationships, again citing Domestic Relations Law 76. The record demonstrates that the child's and the mother's significant connection with New York, as well as the availability of substantial evidence in this case, which is where the child and the mother continue to reside with the maternal great-grandmother, and where the child is enrolled in school and is seen by a pediatrician. So although New York was not the home state of the child under the statutory definition, New York exercised jurisdiction over the case because of these other factors. Next is matter of Starazia on page 15. It's another family law case involving jurisdiction over an out-of-state party. The Third Department, reversing family court, held that father, who was incarcerated in Pennsylvania, should have been allowed to appear in the custody proceeding by telephone. Father had informed the court of his wish to appear and had not challenged the court's jurisdiction, and informed family court he wished to appear by telephone. Family court denied father's request, stating that the court did not have jurisdiction over father. The court wrote, "The right to be heard is fundamental to our system of justice. Further, parents have an equally fundamental interest in the liberty, care, and control of their children. Even an incarcerated parent has a right to be heard on matters concerning his or her child, where there is neither a willful refusal to appear nor a waiver of appearance. Here the father had notice of the proceeding, did not challenge family court's jurisdiction, and the court could have permitted him to testify telephonically. Because the record demonstrates that the father was not given an opportunity to participate in the proceedings, we must reverse and remit for a new hearing." Next is MTGLQ Investments on page 16. It's another jurisdiction case. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that defendants, his name was White, White's attorney's affirmation stating he never received the bank summary judgment motion for a judgment of foreclosure deprived the court of jurisdiction and rendered the judgment a nullity. The court wrote, "The failure to give a party proper notice of a motion deprives the court of jurisdiction to entertain the motion and renders the resulting order void. White's opposition to the plaintiff's motion for a judgment of foreclosure and sale included his attorney's affirmation, where his attorney stated that the attorney never received the summary judgment motion. In reply, the plaintiff did not submit an affidavit of service or other proof of service demonstrating that the summary judgment motion had been served on White's counsel, and therefore the court did not have jurisdiction over the motion." Next is State of New York versus Moore. It's on pages 17 and 18. It's an unusual case where the Supreme Court vacated a judgment because the court had been misled by the plaintiff. In this case, the plaintiff was the State of New York. Third Department held that the Supreme Court properly vacated a judgment pursuant to CPLR 5015 in the interest of substantial justice because plaintiff, again that's the State of New York, had misled the court in proceedings leading to the judgment that it owned land in the Adirondack Park. The court wrote, "Plaintiff argued at trial that although it could not identify the specific instrument that gave it a superior claim to the parcel of land at issue, several instruments granted it title to most of Township 40 and that the parcel was not included within the bounds of any exception. Plaintiff was aware that the success of this argument would threaten the claims of hundreds of individuals to land in Township 40. It became evident that plaintiff sought the 2001 judgment despite the doubts regarding its ownership claims in Township 40. Plaintiff subjected defendants to selectively harsh treatment under a judgment about which it harbored doubts, and Supreme Court stated that it would not have granted the judgment had plaintiff taken the legal position it later adopted. Supreme Court did not abuse its discretion in finding that these circumstances afforded sufficient reason to vacate the judgment in the interest of substantial justice." And again, that was pursuant to CPLR 5015. Next is a matter of Bannister on page 19. It's an Article 78 seeking prohibition against a judge and seeking the dismissal of an indictment in a criminal case. First Department, granting petitioner's application for a writ of prohibition and dismissing the indictment, held the trial court should not have sua sponte declared a mistrial to accommodate a juror's weekend travel plans. Retrial was therefore barred. The court wrote, "The trial court was not compelled by manifest necessity to declare a mistrial and terminate the proceedings, and accordingly, retrial is barred under the double jeopardy clauses of the federal and the New York State constitutions. It was an abuse of discretion to declare a mistrial in order to accommodate a juror's weekend travel plans, including a Friday, which she belatedly informed the court about during deliberations, where the court, as requested by defendant, reasonably could have directed the juror to report for deliberations the following day, and the court also failed to confirm that the jury was hopelessly deadlocked at that time." So the Article 78 seeking a writ of prohibition prohibited the second trial. Next is Deutsche Bank on page 20. The court just explained the criteria for a motion to renew. Second Department reversing Supreme Court in this foreclosure action held the motion to renew should not have been granted, and it explained the criteria for a motion to renew. The court wrote, "In general, a motion for leave to renew must be based upon new facts not offered on the prior motion that would change the prior determination, and must set forth a reasonable justification for the failure to present such facts on the prior motion. It's well settled that a motion for leave to renew is not a second chance freely given to parties who have not exercised due diligence in making their first factual presentation. Indeed, the Supreme Court lacks discretion to grant renewal where the moving party omits a reasonable justification for failing to present the new facts on the original motion. Successive motions for summary judgment should not be entertained in the absence of good cause, such as showing of newly discovered evidence. However, evidence is not newly discovered simply because it was not submitted on the prior motion. Rather, the evidence must not have been available to the party at the time it made its initial motion and could not have been established through alternate evidentiary means." Next is Beach on pages 20 and 21. Here the appellate court found that the sanctions for discovery delay were too severe. First Department, reversing the verdict in favor of plaintiff's employees, determined the sanctions imposed on the employer, that would be the appellant, for a delayed response to discovery demands were too severe, and the First Department ordered a new trial. The plaintiffs alleged the appellant breached oral employment contracts. The appellant, in its counterclaims, alleged plaintiffs breached their fiduciary duty by violating the Securities and Exchange Commission regulations and destroying and replacing handwritten notes about conversations with the appellant. The sanctions effectively prevented the appellant from demonstrating plaintiff's violation of the SEC violations and the destruction of evidence. The court wrote, "Although the court here did not strike a pleading, its ruling could fairly be viewed as having done so, since the precluded evidence was critical to the fiduciary duty claims. Moreover, the court's drastic sanctions were disproportionate to the alleged discovery malfeasance. It is unclear why a short continuance to give plaintiffs time to review the newly produced documents would not have been a viable option, or why further curative instructions would not have sufficed. The record as a whole does not support a finding of willfulness or bad faith so as to justify the severe sanctions imposed. No basis exists to indicate that this was anything other than a disagreement over the scope of discovery. Indeed, the court at trial stated that the alleged discovery omissions appear not to have been in bad faith." So because the sanctions prohibited a party from introducing evidence that was crucial, the First Department ordered a new trial. Next is Prindle on pages 21 and 22. It deals with the reach of the Son of Sam law. The Third Department held the Son of Sam law trumped the CPLR, the Retirement and Social Security law, and the Administrative Code of the City of New York with respect to the pension of a former New York City police officer who was convicted of murder and attempted murder, and against whom plaintiff obtained a personal injury judgment of more than $1 million. The court said, "This court has found that CPLR 5205 subdivision C is superseded by the Son of Sam law. Defendants' assertions that the Retirement and Social Security law and Administrative Code of the City of New York protect his pension from assignment to satisfy plaintiff's money judgment are similarly without merit due to the broad reach of the Son of Sam law." Next is Wells Fargo on page 23. It has to do with proof of standing in a foreclosure case. Second Department reversing Supreme Court held plaintiff bank's motion for summary judgment in this foreclosure action should not have been granted. Plaintiff did not demonstrate it had standing to bring the action. The court wrote, the plaintiff failed to meet its prima facie burden of establishing that it had standing to commence the action. In support of its motion, the plaintiff relied on the affidavit of Melissa Gallio, the vice president of loan documentation for plaintiff. Gallio stated that her knowledge of this case was based upon her review of the books and records maintained by the plaintiff and asserted that the plaintiff was in possession of the note and mortgage as of January 10, 2007. However, Gallio's assertions as to the contents of the records were inadmissible hearsay to the extent that the records she purported to describe were not submitted with her affidavit. While a witness may read into the record from the contents of a document which has been admitted into evidence, a witness's description of a document not admitted into evidence is hearsay. Next is another foreclosure case, Wells Fargo Bank on page 24. It deals with standing again. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that plaintiff bank did not demonstrate standing to bring the foreclosure action. The court wrote, Wells Fargo failed to establish that it had possession of the note prior to the commencement of the action and thus failed to establish that it had standing to foreclose the mortgage. Wells Fargo did not attach a copy of the note and a allonge to the complaint when the action was commenced to establish that it had possession of the note at that time. The affidavit of Wells Fargo's president, vice president of loan documentation was insufficient to establish that Wells Fargo possessed the note at the time the action was commenced. Next is Botanical Realty Association on page 26. It deals with the statute of frauds. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held plaintiff's action alleging breach of an alleged oral contract concerning the repayment of a loan secured by a note and mortgage should have been dismissed as barred by the statute of frauds. The court wrote, the complaint alleged that contemporaneously with executing the note and mortgage, the plaintiffs and the defendant entered into an oral agreement providing that in exchange for assigning a contract to purchase certain real property to the defendant, the plaintiffs would be responsible for paying only the interest on the loan. Enforcement of the alleged oral agreement, ostensibly to modify the note and mortgage, is barred by the statute of frauds, citing General Obligations Law sections 5-703 and 5-1103. Next is Robinson on page 27. It has to do with a sua sponte action taken by the judge. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court in this class action seeking unpaid wages and overtime, held Supreme Court should not have sua sponte declared certain opt-out statements, those opting out of the class action settlement, invalid because the issue was not raised by the plaintiff's motion and the opt-out statements were not properly before the court. The court wrote, a court may grant relief that is warranted by the facts plainly appearing on the papers on both sides if the relief granted is not too dramatically unlike the relief sought. The proof offered supports it, and there's no prejudice to any party. Here the court strayed from this principle. The relief awarded by the court sua sponte in the handwritten provision in the February 2018 order is dramatically unlike the relief sought by the plaintiffs and was prejudicial to the appellants. Moreover, the opt-out statements referred to in the February 2018 order were not among the exhibits submitted on the plaintiff's motion and therefore were not properly before the court for consideration. At this point, I'm going to insert the verification code to be placed on your attorney affirmation for the January 2020 Civil Procedure Update CLE. The verification code is Statute of Frauds. Again, the verification code to be placed on your attorney affirmation for this January 2020 Civil Procedure Update CLE is Statute of Frauds. Next is Bacalan on page 29. It has to do with a summary judgment motion and raising a new theory for the first time in opposition. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the defendant hospital's motion for summary judgment in this medical malpractice action should have been granted. The plaintiffs attempted to raise an evidentiary issue and theory of liability for the first time in opposition to the motion. The court wrote, the plaintiffs improperly alleged for the first time a new theory claiming that other employees of the hospital were negligent in failing to properly administer Decadron and heparin in accordance with the prescription of the plaintiff's attending physician. A plaintiff cannot, for the first time in opposition to a motion for summary judgment, raise a new or materially different theory of recovery against the party from those pleaded in the complaint and in the bill of particulars. Next is the final case, Vargas, on pages 29 and 30. It has to do with a summary jury trial. The First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the trial court should not have sua sponte declared a mistrial in this summary jury trial in an attempt to correct an evidentiary error. The mistrial violated the party's summary jury trial stipulation, which constitutes a binding contract. The court wrote, "The summary jury trial rules to which the parties stipulated provide, among other things, that parties agree to waive any motions for directed verdicts, as well as any motions to set aside the verdict or any judgment rendered by said jury, and that the court shall not set aside any verdict or any judgment entered thereon, nor shall it direct that judgment be entered in favor of a party entitled to judgment as a matter of law, nor shall it order a new trial as to any issues where the verdict is alleged to be contrary to the weight of the evidence." The court erred in sua sponte declaring a mistrial and setting aside the verdict. While this was an attempt to correct an admittedly erroneous evidentiary ruling, the party's stipulation to a summary jury trial, subject to the applicable rules and procedures for Bronx County, was a legally binding contract. Since the summary jury trial rules for Bronx County do not provide for any means to correct errors of law committed during trial, the court exceeded the boundaries of the party's agreement by setting aside the verdict, regardless of whether it in fact did so on its own initiative in the interest of justice. This holding does not prescribe post-trial motions of any kind in connection with summary jury trials. Rather, it abides by the party's own prescriptions made at the time that they stipulated to proceed with a summary jury trial. There was nothing barring the parties from stipulating to reserve their right to appeal or move to set aside the verdict on the ground of an error of law. That concludes this January 2020 Civil Procedure Update CLE.